1971 was a year of changes. Changes that may have set the course for the remainder of the decade. Changes. War in Pakistan. Red China in the United Nations.
The result of the voting is as follows. In favor, 76. Opposed, 35. Abstention, 17. The draft resolution adopted. The government of People's Republic of China will be notified accordingly.
Changes. Great Britain and the common market. Economy in the United States.
I am today ordering a freeze on all prices and wages throughout the United States for a period of 90 days.
Changes. A vote for 18-year-old Americans. A politician and his party.
This morning at Gracie Mansion, Mrs. Lindsay and I enrolled in the Democratic Party.
And where change wasn't made, it was demanded. Attica and Rahway prisons.
Why? Because we have 35 lives, not hostages. A moment's hesitation will cause you their life. Don't play with us.
And so it was in 1971, a year of changes. The audio network of United Press International presents 1971 in Review, a documentary in sound of the major news events of the year. You'll hear the voices of the newsmakers, the sounds of history being made. You'll relive and remember the year 1971. As the year began, many people were asking, how long can this continue? They were referring to the economy of the United States. 1970 was the most inflationary year since the Korean War, and there seemed to be no relief coming. Prices of food and services, construction costs, and wages, like a determined mountain climber, went higher in 1971. Taxes increased in kind and amount. A steamroller effect kept the trend going, and unemployment figures added to the woe. And people complained.
This administration, which pledged to slow inflation and reduce unemployment, has instead given us the highest rate of inflation and the highest rate of unemployment in a decade.
Senator George McGovern of South Dakota wasn't the only one to voice dissent with the administration economic policy, but it was in what might have been a more objective frame of mind that Senator Mike Mansfield of Montana added his view.
What we're in is not a Republican recession or a Democratic recession. Both parties had much to do with bringing us where we are today. But we're facing a national situation which calls for the best which all of us can produce, because if we don't, the results will be something which we will regret.
But no matter who is to blame, if anyone, it was clear something had to be done. Then on a Sunday night in August, Americans listened and the president spoke.
The time has come for decisive action, action that will break the vicious circle of spiraling prices and costs. I am today ordering a freeze on all prices and wages throughout the United States for a period of 90 days. I am relying on the voluntary cooperation of all Americans, each one of you, workers, employers, consumers, to make this freeze work. Working together, we will break the back of inflation.
To promulgate a wage price freeze was a complete turnaround in Nixon's policy, and Senator Jacob Javits of New York praised the decision.
The president's new economic policy and his dedication of the nation to a new prosperity without war spells action. It is bold and welcome.
Labor leaders criticized the move, saying it discriminates against workers. Some Democrats said the action was long overdue. Hubert Humphrey for one.
Well, thank goodness the president has finally acted. But the fact is that for 2 years he refused to act. As a result, millions of Americans are unemployed. Thousands of American investors have been rubbed out in the stock market. Millions of our young people are without work or hope.
The day after the announcement, the president's economic medicine acted like a shot of penicillin on the New York Stock Exchange. Its busiest day in history saw close to 32 million shares traded, and never before had the Dow Jones averages jumped 32.93 points in one day. But despite the initial surge, the stock market was sluggish the rest of the year, and it eventually dropped to new 1971 lows. Economic experts said the confusion and uncertainty about the success of the new economic game plan was the cause. Phase two of Nixon's plan began with the formation of two boards to shape and enforce new economic controls. The pay board said wages had to be held at a maximum 5.5% rise a year. The price board said most items could not have a price rise of more than 2.5% every year. Looking ahead to 1972, the president was optimistic.
Some of you have heard me say that 1972 will be a very good year for the American economy. Let me broaden that estimate tonight. The coming year can be more than a very good year for the American economy. It can be a great year for America and the world. It can be a year for the first time in 15 years in which we can achieve our goal of prosperity in a time of peace.
Great Britain in 1971 had an economic controversy of its own. For 10 years, the British government had sought to join the European common market, and every time they tried, the French and Charles de Gaulle stood in the way. But after a final 12-hour talk by British Prime Minister Edward Heath and French President Georges Pompidou, the way was clear for Britain's entry into the cooperative.
For my part, I have no doubt at all that the discussions which we have had will prove of real and lasting benefit, not only to Britain and France, but to Europe as a whole.
This turning point in the history of Europe was met by some Londoners with more than a dash of skepticism. This man, for instance, had fears of his own.
We'll be talking vive la France, oui, oui, and all that carry on. I mean, for myself, we're Cockneys.
Well, if the common market was not too big a pill for some Englishmen to swallow, the change in their currency system was.
£1 is a 100 new pennies, 100 new pence to the pound.
This jingle was part of the radio campaign to educate the populace with the new decimal system of counting money. The changeover went smoothly, but it reminded some old-timers about the good old days when a penny was a penny.
A penny? I could ride a donkey in Worthing for a penny. I could tie my hair up with ribbon, which only cost a penny a yard. I should like to remind you that in my early teaching days, about 70 years ago, a penny was a very valuable thing, and one thought twice how to use it. Milk, I think I'm right in saying, was a penny a pint.
For a nation with great pride in its traditions, perhaps the biggest shock to Britons in 1971 was the announcement that the maker of the car for kings and movie stars was bankrupt. But it was not the famous automobile which caused the fall of Rolls-Royce, but a contract to build jet plane engines for the Lockheed Aircraft Corporation. As it turned out, Lockheed had problems of its own, and it was a one-vote victory in the Senate that gave them a government loan for $250 million. That loan saved Lockheed from the same fate as Rolls-Royce.
Fellow delegates, the issue is clearly marked now. Inclusion or expulsion? Impartiality or one-sided and arbitrary punishment? If this is not an important question, what is?
George Bush, U.S. Ambassador to the United Nations. It's the floor of the General Assembly. For the 21st time, the delegates were debating the admission of Red China into the world body. The U.S. was attempting to make the expulsion of nationalist China an important question requiring a two-thirds vote. The motion was defeated. What was coming next was clear to everyone, and nationalist China decided not to stay around.
The delegation of the Republic of China has now decided not to take part to any further proceedings of this General Assembly. We shall continue to struggle with the like-minded governments for the realization of the ideals upon which the United Nations was founded, but which the General Assembly has now betrayed.
The longest debate in the history of the UN was about to end.
The result of the voting is as follows: in favor 76, opposed 35, abstention 17. The draft resolution adopted. The government of People's Republic of China will be notified accordingly.
With that vote, Communist China was admitted into the UN and Nationalist China expelled. There were cheers, smiles, laughter, and applause. But none showed their pleasure more than the young chief delegate from Tanzania who performed an African victory jig in the front row. For the United States, the expulsion of nationalist China was considered a defeat in the international arena. It was a defeat many didn't like, Senator Barry Goldwater for one.
I suggested on the floor of the Senate today that we stop all funds for the United Nations. Now, what that'll do to the United Nations, I don't know. I have a hunch it would cause them to fold up, which would make me very happy at this particular point. I think if this happens, they can well move their headquarters to Peking or Moscow and get them out of this country.
Actually, a U.S. attitude and policy change toward Red China had become apparent early in the year when the president announced some travel and trade restrictions had been lifted. And in August, the U.S. officially endorsed a two-China policy for the U.N. But it was an event back in April that had the China watchers running to their crystal balls for an interpretation of the very unusual happening. The Chinese invited a group of Americans to visit the mainland. The Americans all happened to be ping-pong players. Naturally, they went to play ping-pong. And when they returned, one of the players told what he saw.
People are just like us. They're real, they're genuine, they got feelings. I made friends, I made genuine friends, you see? The country is similar to America, but still very different. It's beautiful. They got Great Wall, they got planes over there. They got an ancient palace with parks and streams, and they got goats and horses, all kinds of, you know, animals. The country changes from the south to the north. The people, they have a unity. They really believe in their values.
After this ping-pong diplomacy, any doubts about a thaw in the U.S.-China Cold War were put aside in July when Nixon read this announcement at the same time it was being read in China.
Premier Chou Enlai and Dr. Henry Kissinger, President Nixon's assistant for national security affairs, held talks in Peking from July 9 to 11, 1971. Knowing of President Nixon's expressed desire to visit the People's Republic of China, Premier Chou Enlai, on behalf of the government of the People's Republic of China, has extended an invitation to President Nixon to visit China at an appropriate date before May 1972. President Nixon has accepted the invitation with pleasure.
3 months after this announcement, the president announced he was making another trip in 1972. This time it was Russia.
Neither trip is being taken for the purpose of exploiting what differences may exist between the two nations. Neither is being taken at the expense of any other nation. The trips are being taken for the purpose of better relations between the United States and the Soviet Union, and better relations between the United States and the People's Republic of China.
For the Russian leaders, the trips came this year. During October, the three top Kremlin leaders were globe-hopping jet-set politicians on an intense diplomatic offensive. But it was Premier Alexei Kosygin's 9-day trip to Canada that brought excitement. Protest marches staged by Ukrainians, Latvians, Czechs, and Jews were one thing, but in Ottawa, a young Hungarian freedom fighter was something else.
Mr. Kosygin had just completed a meeting with Prime Minister Trudeau in the center block of the Parliament buildings, and instead of riding to the Chateau Laurier in his limousine, he decided to walk with Prime Minister Trudeau. Just as the two men were approaching the east block, a young man appearing to be in his mid to late 20s, wearing a black leather jacket, leaped through the security guards and reporters and grabbed the premier around his neck. The man, yelling freedom for Hungary, was immediately thrown to the ground, then hauled to the RCMP office on Parliament Hill. The premier appeared to be visibly shaken, but not injured. He walked the remaining few yards into the east block.
In another diplomatic move, Russia signed a 20-year friendship pact with India. That agreement came in the middle of a hot dispute India was having with Pakistan. Strained relations between East and West Pakistan led to rioting and strikes in the East. Finally, an army from the West moved to crush Bangladesh rebels who wanted the eastern part of the nation for themselves. India took sides with the rebels, and soon it was apparent the trouble was inevitable. Pakistani President Yahya Khan said his country was ready.
I can't just tell my armies to stop firing and take it. You don't come from a creed that believes in somebody slaps you on one cheek and you turn the other cheek. I'm afraid for the defense of my country, I will not turn the other cheek, I'll hit back.
An Indian president, Indira Gandhi, was willing.
India has always stood out against war, no matter where it took place. But there are things which are more important. And today we feel that not only for the sake of the Indian people, but for the peace in Asia, and I would say world peace, stability, integrity, and the security of India is the first importance.
Skirmishes began, and by the year's end, all-out war. Those are not the Bangladesh or the Viet Cong. They're rebels of a different sort. They're Americans, some old, but mostly young. They carry signs and shout slogans. They demonstrate against poverty, racial inequality, but mostly against the war in Indochina. They pop up in many cities, but mostly in Washington, D.C. They've been around for a few years, and 1971 was no exception. The first major demonstration in the nation's capital in 1971 was organized by a group called Vietnam Veterans Against the War. They demonstrated with mock search and destroy missions on the Capitol Mall, with guerrilla theater and toy M16 rifles on the steps of the Capitol. The men, some without limbs and being pushed in wheelchairs, ended their week stay this way.
A World War II Army sergeant blew taps over the last ceremony of the veterans' protest against the war. As ex-GIs unpinned their medals, former Sergeant Dale Olson blew taps for the son he lost in Vietnam and for all the people who have died in America's longest war. The ceremony had begun with a short speech from one of the veterans.
We now strip ourselves of those medals for courage and heroism and dedicate ourselves now to the peace and brotherhood this nation once held as its heritage.
And then the Purple Hearts, the Silver Stars, Bronze Stars rained down on the broad plaza beneath the Capitol Dome.
Bob Smeal died for these medals. Lieutenant Pomeroy died so I got a medal. Sergeant Johns died so I got a medal. I got a Silver Star, Purple Heart, Army Commendation Medal, 8 Air Medals, National Defense, and the rest of this garbage. It doesn't mean a thing.
An articulate spokesman for the group was former Navy Lieutenant John Kerry. He spoke to a Senate hearing.
Each day to facilitate the process by which the United States washes her hands of Vietnam, someone has to give up his life so that the United States doesn't have to admit something that the entire world already knows, so that we can't say that we've made a mistake. Someone has to die so that President Nixon won't be, and these are his words, the first president to lose a war. And we are asking Americans to think about that. Because how do you ask a man to be the last man to die in Vietnam?
But the veterans' demonstration was only a prelude. The May Day demonstration brought people to Washington who said that because the government had not stopped the war, they would stop the government.
Attention, attention. This is the Metropolitan Police Department. Be advised that the president...
Washington braced itself. The May Day tribe's purpose was clear. Block the streets, stop traffic, harass officials, and maybe this way no one would get to work, and the government for at least one day would stop. Well, it didn't work.
Police Chief Jerry Wilson is moving up. There are several hundred policemen behind him, standing shoulder to shoulder in a long, fairly straight line. Right here, where about 45 demonstrators are sitting, waiting and hoping to be arrested. Approximately 10 commercial television camera crews, innumerable microphones, and here's the first arrest. They're going very peacefully.
Sure am. Wouldn't argue with them. That's their job, right?
And they're loading the demonstrators into a khaki bus.
Eventually, 12,000 persons were arrested, and everyone got to work, a little late, but nonetheless they got there. Two Supreme Court positions were filled in 1971. The post became available with the retirement of Justice John Harlan and the retirement of Hugo Black, who died a week after he announced his leave. The two new justices, Lewis Powell and William Rehnquist, were approved by the Senate with much less controversy than other Nixon candidates. The president has now appointed 4 of the 9 justices who sit on the court. One of the major decisions of the Supreme Court in 1971 was their unanimous upholding of the constitutionality of busing to end officially imposed school segregation and dual school systems. The issue of busing got confused when the president asserted he was opposed to busing as a means of achieving racial balance when it meant going beyond the minimum required by law. This brought a reply from Alabama Governor George Wallace.
Governor Wallace is working very closely with President Nixon in order to help him be able to carry out his objective of no massive busing in Alabama. And I would hope that the governors of the other states would oblige and help the president as much as I desire to help him carry out his desire not to have massive busing.
While he did not officially announce his candidacy in 1971, George Wallace is considered a possible third-party candidate for 1972. New York City Mayor John Lindsay didn't announce his candidacy either in 1971, But the man who seconded the vice presidential nomination of Spiro Agnew at the Republican National Convention in 1968 did make this announcement.
This morning at Gracie Mansion, Mrs. Lindsay and I enrolled in the Democratic Party. In a sense, this step recognizes the failure of 20 years in progressive Republican politics. In another sense, it represents a renewed decision to fight for new national leadership.
Of course, reporters asked Lindsay the inevitable question.
I'm not a candidate. I'm not announcing a candidacy. I'm not a candidate for any office.
Whoever does run, one thing is sure. He'll be trying hard for the vote of 25 million potential young voters who have never voted in a presidential election. Of these, more than 11 million will be 18 to 20-year-old young citizens who are given the right to vote in all elections when the 26th Amendment to the Constitution was approved in 1971. If talk about future or potential presidential candidates got to be a little too much for the White House watchers in 1971, they had the opportunity to turn to less mundane matters. The president's eldest daughter, Tricia, married Edward Finch Cox in the White House Rose Garden. And despite the controversy surrounding the wedding cake, those who were there said it wasn't mushy on the outside or soupy on the inside. It was just fine. The Tricia Nixon wedding was dutifully reported the next day in newspapers all over the nation. But on that Sunday, June 13th, one paper had something on the front page that no other paper had. For on that day, the New York Times began publishing top-secret, sensitive details and documents from 47 volumes that comprised the history of the U.S. decision-making process on Vietnam policy, better known as the Pentagon Papers. After the government said the publication of this material would cause irreparable injury to the defense interest of the United States, a federal judge ordered the Times to temporarily halt the publication of the papers. The Times said what was revealed had to be revealed, that people had the right to know. Times publisher Arthur Ock Sulzberger.
These papers, I think as our editorial said this morning, were really a part of history that should have been made available considerably longer ago. And I just didn't feel there was any breach of national security in the sense that we were giving secrets to the enemy.
The argument moved swiftly to the Supreme Court, which ruled 6-3 that the First Amendment guarantee of a free press outweighed the government's claim to potential harm to national security. One of the more enlightening facts disclosed by the papers was the point that the decision to bomb North Vietnam was made by President Johnson before the 1964 elections. It was the president's opponent, Barry Goldwater, who was an advocate of that very position.
During the campaign, President Johnson kept reiterating that he would never send American boys to fight in Vietnam. As I say, he knew at the time that American boys were going to be sent. In fact, I knew about 10 days before the Republican convention. You see, I was being called a trigger-happy, warmonger, bomb-happy. All the time Johnson was saying he'd never send American boys, and I knew damn well he would.
Birch Bayh was one of the senators who thought the publication of the Pentagon Papers was the right thing to do.
The existence of these documents and the fact that they said one thing and the people were led to believe something else is the reason we have a credibility gap today, the reason people don't believe their government. This is the same thing that's been going on over the last 2.5 years of this administration. There's a difference between what the president says and what the government actually does. And I have confidence that they're going to make the right decision if they have all the facts.
2 days before the Supreme Court decision, Daniel Ellsberg, an MIT senior research associate, surrendered to federal authorities in Boston and admitted giving the papers to the press. He was indicted by a grand jury in Los Angeles on charges of having stolen and held secret documents.
I felt that as an American citizen, as a responsible citizen, I could no longer cooperate in concealing this information from the American public.
Dr. Ellsberg,
I did this clearly at my own jeopardy, and I am prepared to answer to all the consequences of these decisions.
The publication of the Pentagon Papers stirred again the controversy of how the Vietnam War began and why it continued, even while the war itself in 1971 appeared to be winding down day by day. By the end of the year, fewer than 200,000 U.S. troops were in Vietnam. 1 week, the weekly combat death rate was lower than any week since 1965. Vietnamization was proceeding and was climaxed by a 44-day drive into Laos to destroy the Ho Chi Minh Trail. American participation was diminishing, but true peace still seemed far away. In Paris, peace talks continued to get nowhere, and there were still prisoners of war on both sides. Elections were held in South Vietnam. The winner was incumbent President Nguyen Van Thieu. It was an easy race. He was the only candidate. In the United States, memories of grimmer days in Vietnam were recalled during the trial of Lieutenant William Calley, Jr. The longest court-martial in history ended when the lieutenant was found guilty of premeditated murder of 22 South Vietnamese men, women, and children in My Lai in 1968. He was sentenced to life imprisonment. Pai Chamberlain reports.
Lieutenant Keller walks out. Ragged chair. Kelly salutes the crowd, about 100 people. Two MPs escort him. He gets into the khaki MP car. Door slams. Second door slams. People waving a peace sign at Kelly. He's driven away. He's just been sentenced to spend the rest of his natural life in prison. It's a beautiful, bright spring day. Kelly has shown no more emotion this time than he did at the verdict phase when he was convicted of premeditated murder. In the court, Kelly's face was bright red. Nonetheless, he saluted after the punishment was announced and said, "I'll do my best, sir."
A wave of protest spread throughout the country. The governor of Indiana ordered all state flags flown at half-mast. A four-man draft board in Virginia resigned. Automobile stickers and billboards demanded free Kelly. In a sense, the plea was heard at the White House. The president ordered Kelly released from the stockade to his own quarters under house arrest, and the president promised to review the sentencing. The 29-year-old prosecutor of the trial, Aubrey Daniel, accused the president of damaging the military judicial system and called his move improper.
My intervention in the Kelly case was proper for two reasons. One, because I felt that Captain Kelly should not be sent to Leavenworth prison while waiting for the months and maybe a year or so that appeal would take. I thought that he should be confined to quarters. I think that was proper to do. And second, I felt that it was proper for me to indicate that I would review the case because there was great concern expressed throughout the country as to whether or not this was a case involving, as it did, so many complex factors in which Captain Kelly was going to get a fair trial.
Finally, in August, the life sentence of Lieutenant Kelly was changed.
The commanding general of the 3rd U.S. Army, Lieutenant General Albert O'Connor, has approved the findings of guilty and only so much of the sentence that provides for dismissal, forfeiture of all pay and allowances, and confinement for 20 years.
In a related trial, Captain Ernest Medina, Lieutenant Kelly's immediate superior officer, was acquitted of all charges in the deaths of more than 100 South Vietnamese civilians. The military jury deliberated and made their decision in about 60 minutes. Vietnam veterans speak of the fear of walking the jungle, of encountering the unseen enemy, the guerrilla, the sniper. In Northern Ireland, where the cancer of civil strife between Catholics and Protestants has grown year after year, 1971 was a year filled with that kind of fear. In Belfast, you could answer a knock on your door and be shot dead. Your Christmas shopping could be cut short when a bomb explodes in the aisle of the store. Or you could walk the streets and have a sniper lining you up in his rifle sights. These men were only a small part of the 12,000 British troops who were sent to Northern Ireland in 1971. They moved quickly, carefully, as they hunted down a sniper in the streets of Belfast.
Steady flashes, Jimmy. Where's it coming from? Can you see it? Which room?
If there was a change in Northern Ireland in 1971, it was from bad to worse. Four more Americans made it to the moon in 1971. In two separate flights, they achieved more space first, more records, and more excitement. The first pair, in the Antares moonship, made the closest to the target landing of all Apollos. Alan Shepard, America's first and oldest astronaut, climbed out of the lunar craft first.
Okay, Al, beautiful. We can see you coming down the ladder right now. It looks like you're about on the bottom step and on the surface. That's it for an old man.
Okay, you're right. Al is on the surface, and it's been a long way, but we're here.
Along with Ed Mitchell, Shepard hiked the Fra Mauro region of the moon in a two-part, 33-and-one-half-hour scientific expedition. They brought back to Earth 96 pounds of rock, some of which dated back over 4 billion years. But before returning to Earth, Shepard pulled out a bogus six-iron and gained the envy of all the duffers of the world.
Houston, while you're looking that up, you might recognize what I have in my hand is the handle for the contingency sample return. It just so happens to have a genuine six-iron on the bottom of it. In my left hand, I have a little white pellet that's familiar to millions of Americans. Drop it down. Unfortunately, the suit is so stiff I can't do this with two hands, but I'm going to try a little sand trap shot here. Before I dirt them below, here we go again.
That looked like a slice to me, Al.
There we go. Three to die. One more. Miles and miles and miles.
America's next group left in July on what NASA called the most successful manned flight ever achieved. When Dave Scott and James Irwin got to the surface of the moon, there wasn't a paved highway, but there wasn't any traffic either. You can be sure they were the only two on the moon, and the only two on the moon driving a car.
The rover handles quite well. We're moving, I guess, an average of about 8 kilometers an hour. It's got very low damping compared to the 1G rover, but the stability is about the same. It feels like we need the seat belts, doesn't it, Jim?
Yeah, really do.
The steering is quite responsive, even with only the rear steering. It does quite well. There doesn't seem to be too much slip. I can maneuver pretty well with the thing.
The men explored the moon's surface and the electric moon buggy for 18 hours and 37 minutes. But their most enthusiastic moment seemed to be when they were picking up rock samples.
I wish we could just sit down and play with the rocks for a while. Look at these things. They're shiny, sparkly.
So after missing a moon landing in 1970, the Apollo 14 and 15 moon missions of 1971 put the United States that much closer to the end of its Apollo series of space flights. For Russia, the year in space was both triumphant and tragic. They launched the world's first space station in April, and they had a successful docking with Soyuz 10. They sent rockets to Mars, which landed and sent back important and valuable scientific information. But the Russian successes in space during 1971 were overshadowed by a black shroud of grief. On June the 30th, after almost 24 days in space, Soviet Soyuz 11 headed back to Earth. The three cosmonauts aboard had set a new space endurance record. They had successfully docked with an unmanned space station, and now they were only a short time away from a hero's welcome through Red Square. Cosmonauts are Russia's biggest heroes. If you were a Russian in Moscow that day, you would have heard the solemn tone voice of the radio announcer.
Московское время 9 часов. Передаем сообщение так.
The ship made a soft, safe landing. A helicopter recovery group opened the hatch of the capsule, and there, still strapped into their seats, were the three Soviet cosmonauts, their faces frozen into expressionless masks. Three Soviet heroes whose bodies were still. Three Soviet cosmonauts, dead. In the Middle East, the conflict between the Jews and the Arabs came no closer to solution. Jerry Lachlan reports from Beirut.
War threat grows. This was the most persistent headline in Middle East newspapers throughout 1971. And as the year drew to its close, it looked like the threat might be realized. President Sadat of Egypt announced he had despaired of a peaceful solution. He had broken off contacts with the United States. He had decided to go to war with Israel. A far cry from the comparative optimism with which the year began. Sadat began talking of 1971 as the year of decision. In speech after speech, he said a decision must be made for war or peace. Finally, he announced it. war, but not apparently war immediately. Egypt launched a diplomatic offensive aimed at securing a General Assembly resolution backing the Yaring Memorandum. This, in effect, meant a worldwide demand for Israel to withdraw. If it agreed, then victory was Egypt. If it refused, then Sadat was in a position of much moral credit from which to launch his battle. If, that is, Israel did not strike first.
Israeli Prime Minister Golda Meir.
Israel will not, cannot be scared, bullied into a position which it will not accept because it believes that it is not good for its security. This is our position. And if Sadat would think likewise, maybe we would have had peace by this time.
Four days had passed since the 1,200 inmates at the Attica State Correctional Facility in New York had taken over. They had 38 hostages. They made demands to the State Corrections Commissioner Russell Oswald from what seemed to be a position of strength.
It seems to me that you're an artist at prevarication. I bear witness to your evil deeds, Mr. Oswald. Now, I repeat, as I told you yesterday, we're being lenient with you. We're negotiating. We're talking. We shouldn't be. We should be demanding. Why? Because we have 35 lives, not hostages. And I repeat, Mr. Oswald, a moment's hesitation will cause you their life. Don't play with us.
The situation developed into a tense standoff. Bobby Seale, militant chairman of the Black Panther Party, was called to the scene. Attorney William Kunstler spoke to and for the inmates. Outsiders were called in to negotiate, but no one gave ground. Then New York Governor Nelson Rockefeller gave the word, and more than 1,000 New York State troopers and local police stormed the prison.
I only wish I had a gas mask so I could be up there closer. Can you hear the helicopters making another pass? This apparently is the move that we've been expecting. I'm glad you can hear gunfire. There's a PA system. There's been mention of the fact of hostages. The message is saying, release the hostages and lay down. Release the hostages and lay down.
When it was over, confusion and false reports led to claims that inmates had cut the throats of hostages. But autopsy reports showed they had been shot in the assault by the weapons belonging to the police. One hostage, a prison guard, told of his ordeal.
The man that was behind me was an inmate that I had known for some time, and he was one of the inmates that took care of us, and he whispered in my ear that I would not be hurt. He was supposed to stick a knife between my ribs. He stuck the knife just to pick the skin, and he said, "Now don't tell him that I didn't kill you." And then he threw me backwards, not on the mattresses, on the ground, and he covered my body with his. When it was over, he was dead.
Commissioner Oswald said the attack was the only way.
I believe that if I had the choice, I would undoubtedly have to do the same thing again.
43 men eventually died from the Attica uprising. Attorney William Kunstler puts the blame for their deaths on Governor Rockefeller.
I call him a murderer. I am libeling him under the law of our state. And I dare him to sue me in any court he chooses to sue. He is a murderer, a corrupt, indecent figure. And under him, other men were forced to kill. They murdered, just as we accused William Calley of murdering at My Lai. But they not only murdered their enemies, the prisoners, they murdered their employees, the guards.
Prisoners at the New Jersey State Prison in Rahway took over that facility on Thanksgiving Day. The next day, the rebellion was over. No injuries, no deaths. There were six men killed when inmates at San Quentin tried to escape. One of those killed was George Jackson. Jackson was the brother of Jonathan, who had been killed in a shootout in August 1970 after he smuggled guns into a California courtroom to help three convicts escape. Part of that case is still untried. In connection with that case, Angela Davis, the black self-proclaimed communist, goes on trial in 1972 on charges of kidnapping and murder. In a trial that was completed in 1971, Charles Manson and three female members of his so-called family were found guilty of the grotesque 1969 murders of actress Sharon Tate and four others.
Nobody knows the trouble I've seen.
The king was dead. That's what they said when Louis Armstrong died. The great jazz trumpeter passed away 2 days after his 71st birthday on July 4th. Satchmo, perhaps the single greatest figure in jazz, grew up in a New Orleans orphanage and became a musical ambassador for the United States, playing for kings and queens and traveling all over the world. Peggy Lee sang the Lord's Prayer at his funeral, and Al Hibbler, Nobody Knows the Trouble I've Seen. The eulogy was given by Fred Robbins, radio personality and longtime friend. A few days before he died, Louis played his trumpet. Little did he know then he wouldn't be playing it very many more times.
Louis Armstrong was a lovable, beautiful, darling man. A beautiful soul. He loved all kinds of people. All kinds of people loved him. He had a full, rich, rewarding life. It was an epic. And he had a flaw. He spread a lot of sunshine around. Move over, Gabriel. And here comes Satchmo. The saints are marching in. And so Pops takes his place as the king at the head of that big jam session in the sky. And that special niche in heaven that God keeps to hold our idols.
And so another year has gone, and a new one is born. 1971 was a year of changes, some good, some not so good. But whether good or bad, we'll look back and say, 1971, what a year. You've been listening to 1971 in Review, a production of the United Press International Audio Network. This program was written, produced, and directed by Stan Sabick. Technical direction by Bill Wilson. This is Ed Cairns.